Women have been giving birth for centuries, so it's a pretty natural experience, right? Wrong. I'm Stephanie King, professional doula, childbirth educator, and the creator of the My Essential Birth course, the online childbirth education course that's helping women everywhere confidently achieve their best birth. Today's culture would have us think that birth should be treated like an illness or an emergency, and that most of us need other people telling us what's best for our bodies because we aren't the experts. So sit tight, because if you're tuning into this podcast, you'll probably start to believe in your body, your intuition, and find yourself empowered and confident to do what it takes to have the birth of your dreams. If you like listening to me take you through these weekly topics step by step, then you're going to love the My Essential Birth course. Make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast and definitely head over to myessentialbirth.com for the free downloads mentioned right here in these episodes and to join the birth course and community full of pregnant moms just like you. I have to add a disclaimer that I am not a medical professional and I cannot provide medical advice. All of the information expressed in this podcast are based off of personal, professional, and educational experiences and are my own opinions. Please work with a provider you trust for medical advice during your pregnancy and birth. Welcome back to the podcast. And our reviewer of the week is Epultar, E-P-U-L-T-A-R. She says, I listened to every episode during my first pregnancy 2 years ago, about to go through it all again with my second pregnancy. This podcast and Stephanie's Instagram really helped me feel like such a strong, educated mama when it came down to delivery. I don't think it would have gone as smoothly as it did without her. Now I know what I'm capable of and I'm not scared at all for the next one. Thank you so much for all of this helpful information. Thank you for your review. Thank you for being back again. Congratulations on pregnancy number two. And I feel like you're going to enjoy today's podcast episode. For those of you that are listening, I'm pretty excited to have Kim West here with me. I'm going to let her introduce herself in just a moment. But this is a topic we get to talk about today, which has to do with newborn sleep. That we get to talk about a little bit of what happens during pregnancy to prepare you for having a newborn and what's going to come with newborn sleep, as well as what to expect postpartum and going into those next couple of months. So, Kim, will you take a moment and introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Hi, Stephanie. I'm Kim West. I'm a mother of two. I am a licensed family therapist for 30 years, and I was dubbed the name probably 25 years ago, the sleep lady, by a little three-year-old when I was doing sleep coaching and I created the first gentle sleep coaching method. And now I'm applying that to newborns.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you've sent me your book. So we'll get to talking about all of the incredible stuff that you have to offer. And we'll make sure to link everything for those of you that are listening in the show notes. But you have a ton. You're just a wealth of information when you say, you know, 30 years and kids of your own and being able to teach mothers. Yeah. It's just huge. I love that you're in the space and I love that you've remained there because that's where we get the knowledge and the wisdom of the years of teaching. You said, so in here you talk about developing a gentle approach to sleep coaching. Will you talk a little bit about what led you to do that?
So when I had my first daughter, who is 28 years old now, can't even believe it. At the time, the only thing we had was a book, and it was a paperback. So imagine we didn't have digital. I know that makes me sound like a dinosaur, but was Ferber's book here in America. Apparently there wasn't another book also in Europe. And that was put your baby in their crib, drowsy but awake, and leave the room. And let them cry and go in, and you could go in and check on them in sort of what I call time checks or in timed increments. And I wasn't convinced that that actually made any sense from what I knew as a family therapist in supporting a secure attachment. And even sort of like logically, I thought to myself, what are they learning by this? It was sort of, and I thought the same thing in graduate school. You know, when we do 2 years of internships, and then I would be working with kids, little kids, and they would have a temper tantrum. And at the time, and this is still told to us as parents, you're supposed to A, walk away when they have a tantrum, and then B, if that doesn't work, or maybe shortly thereafter, do time out. And I never understood, like, so you make a child go sit in a chair, and what if they don't stay in the chair? And then what are they also learning from that? So it's sort of, and I thought, well, let me have a child. What do I know? Right. And had a child. And then I found that it was the same thing. So I thought, well, if they don't have the skills to the infamous self-soothe, which newborns don't, then I need to help be there for them to reassure them, and that I could start to do less and less as they grew more and developed more skills. And so I applied that first in my first book to babies 6 months and older. And I developed and I experimented on my first child. She's turned out to, I always say she's the cutest guinea pig I know, and turned out well, with this gentle approach where I stayed with her when she was old enough, as she learned the skills of putting herself to sleep independently. I offered physical and verbal reassurance, and then I slowly moved away, did less and less as she was able to incorporate the skill herself. And I coached families through that process, and it was hugely successful, I think, because, well, most times our biggest fear and concern is in leaving our child to cry it out. We feel guilty, we're worried, and it makes it really hard for us to be consistent.
Yeah.
And then we give mixed messages, and that makes the problem worse. And secondly, because I was coaching them through the whole process, each parent had, you know, support, an objective person to offer, you know, strategies, and they were successful. And so it just really took off from there on its own, because, as you know, sleep is like the best gift of all.
You just can't function without it. I have another name for you. I'm going to call you the sleep doula, because as you were explaining everything that you do, and that's exactly what doulas do, like in the birth space, I'm just an extra person there that can say, you're doing fine, it's okay. And that assurance is everything. It was the same in my own birth with my own doula. It's like, she's not freaking out, I don't need to freak out. She said that was good. Okay, I can trust that my husband said that was good. You know what I mean? So, I mean, that's awesome. I just love it. And what you're talking about, too, I feel like speaks to the mom heart. Like, we've got these two systems, like, right? Like, we've got our mind, but we also have our emotions. And when those things are not connected, like you were saying, logically, okay, yeah, it can make sense that my baby needs to maybe learn to be by themselves. So you can talk yourself into the logic of different methods. But when you're pulling away and your baby's crying and you can't handle it because your mom heart is saying that's not right, it doesn't connect. Mm-hmm. So I feel like what you're describing makes sense as a mother, how those, you know, logically this makes sense, and I feel okay with it, which is kind of where you want to be.
And also sometimes it's okay to say, I don't know if that logically makes sense for my baby, for me in this moment, you know, and that I really feel like we have to kind of empower parents to listen to their gut, you know, and their intuition. Yeah. I think we have so many distractions. I mean, we had a ton when I was a young parent, but it's even more now, you know, that pulls us outside of ourselves and looking for answers outside. And so I always, you know, encourage parents to say, okay, so maybe I learned this stuff over here. And by the way, I include whatever advice I give you too. And now how does that feel in here, in my heart and in my gut?
Yeah. Oh, that's perfect. Yeah. Yes. Mother's intuition is a very real thing. And it's not just for pregnancy and birth. It's the rest of their lives. You're going to have that intuition, and you can tune into it. I love that you mentioned that. Yeah. You wrote this new book. Was it that, or how does this method and approach differ from the first book? Because you have a first book, and now you have this book. We maybe talk about the difference between the two and why you felt inspired to write the second.
Sure. So my first book, which is The Sleep Lady's Good Night Sleep Tight, that's been out for 19 years selling consistently. It was really one of the first with this gentle approach. And it was really meant for parents of children 6 months to 6 years old. And I had some newborn sections in it. And during the third edition, I pulled out, I mean, I have a, you know, chapter or so on the younger babies, but not because I want you to sleep train them. And I found that parents were so desperate and being told messages of sleep train your newborn at 1 week, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. And largely the best way to do it is what these parents are being told is by cry it out.
Right.
And that if you can't do it, you know, it's because you weren't strong enough and you'll have a lifetime of problems. And I was like, what? Wait a minute. First of all, that's not fair and accurate. Or maybe that's first. And secondly, that's not accurate. And I wanted to kind of do justice to a delicate time, you know, both for the baby and for us as parents. Yeah. And so 3 years ago, when we did the third edition of my first book, pulled that newborn information out, did more sort of broad strokes on newborns, and then dedicated, you know, this whole next book on the 0 to 5 months. And I know that, you know, not everybody calls like a 4 and 5 month old a newborn, but I wanted to address this whole age group and really sort of like scream from a mountaintop that you don't have to let these babies cry it out. And honestly, I hope you don't actually, you know. And if you did, by the way, and you're listening to this, and it went well, I don't feel guilty. I don't want you to feel like, oh no, you've done something to your child. Most of the people that I'm talking to are either having, you know, unrealistic expectations of their newborn, or they maybe listened to some of this advice and they tried it and they had one of those babies that doesn't cry just 5 minutes and then sleeps through the night,
right.
You know? And so this is for either the parents who don't want to do that from the get-go or who tried and unfairly now feel like a failure, you know, because you're not a failure. It may very well be that your child wasn't ready and we have to factor in all these other elements that we'll probably talk about today. So I feel really strongly about that. And I want to lift that guilt, you know, weight that is put on all those parents now for being told that you got to let your newborn cry it out.
Yeah. And I was one of those moms. My first baby, mm-hmm. and he had really bad colic or, you know, whatever was going on. He was crying all the time and I needed a break. Yeah. And I heard about cry it out and I put him in there to cry. And then he's crying and I'm in the other room. And even though I need a break, I'm sitting there like, I can't handle this and I don't want to do this. And I remember I took a picture of him one time and I actually think he was about 4 or 5 months. And I do consider that newborn myself. And there was a picture of he was in his crib and he had his little head. He had fallen asleep. He was sitting up, had his head up against the crib and just this tear. And it broke me. I'm going to get emotional about it right now. And I'm like, who does that? Like me as a mom, like he was sitting here crying for me, asking for help. It's how they communicate. He wasn't doing anything wrong. He doesn't need to self-soothe in this moment. He needed his mommy. And that was a realization for me of like, no, I'm here to help you feel comfortable, to help you feel safe, to be, you know, comfortable wherever you're at and be able to sleep better that way. You're going to sleep better. I mean, as an adult, if my husband leaves for a night or two, he's gone for a week, I don't sleep well, you know? And here we've got a baby, this little baby that's completely dependent on me, who's been in my body for 9 months. And you come out and I'm like, okay, I need distance. You know, what does that do? I mean, so I understand both sides of the like, yes, don't feel guilty if that was you. But also, it's okay to recognize that that is how babies communicate and it is normal and natural and that and loving on them for it or allowing them to cry with you or not putting them down to cry it out is also okay, and you can trust your intuition and gut on that. So I'm with
and
you.
And it doesn't have to be, I do cry it out, or I'm going to have sleepless, you right. know, chaos and right. depression yeah. for six
I'm
months
glad you
or
said
a
that.
Year
yes.
either.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I've been that mom. So I just appreciate the message yeah. that you were saying. I think it's extremely, extremely needed. Actually, before we get into, because I do want to kind of lead into this newborn phase and I want to talk about these things, something that I noticed as I was kind of glancing through your book and reading a couple of topics was you talked about things that moms can do now during pregnancy, even before baby's born. One of the things that you talked about actually had to do with trauma, which I thought was so kind of like eye-opening and something that I talk about, right, when we're talking about pregnancy and birth and all of that and, yeah. you know, all the work that we do to try to avoid a traumatic birth experience and whatever. Not that it doesn't happen and that there's steps that you can take or you can have a great experience and you still experience trauma. However, I thought it was really interesting that you mm-hmm. connected having some trauma during pregnancy and or birth with how your baby's sleeping or that connection after. We talk about that just mm-hmm. for a moment before we dive into the newborn stuff.
Mm. Mm. Such a big...
Sorry.
No. I think that, it, like, even if you just step back for a moment and look at trauma as a piece of the big picture, that when we have children and or give birth to a baby or adopt a baby and are right, our childhood unresolved issues will also come to the forefront, particularly usually often at the age your child is that you might have experienced mm-hmm. a trauma. But if you are a pregnant parent too, or a pregnant mom, soon to be parent, and you know that you've already experienced trauma, then I encourage you to have support in your life now. Whether that's seeing a therapist, whether it's, well, of course I'm biased. I think it's great to see a therapist.
I do too.
and a good one, right? You know, one you really connect with and feel safe with, and also who understands postpartum, because not all of them do. And being prepared for that, particularly even if you've had some, you know, you've been treated for depression or anxiety that put things that will put you at higher risk after you give birth. And then when we go into birth and, you know, look, this is important. What you consider trauma, Stephanie, and what I consider trauma can be vastly different.
Yes.
Right. And I give some examples of that in my book. And that's important to know too, right? And then once, you know, when you're planning your birth plan, you know more about this as, you know, a birth doula, that I like to think of it as a wish list, like Dr. Sho says, because we can't always control, or we can't control what how our birth will be. We can have, you know, a wish for it. And that even if you have, you know, a birth that didn't end up being an emergency C-section, your baby is healthy, you can still experience trauma in the birth. Could be the way you're treated by somebody, a separation, you know, your partner goes in another room, there's a, you know, 10-minute scare about the baby or whatever it is that triggers you. I just want moms to be aware and to ask for support, because that does end up affecting your emotional well-being when you have your baby at home. And, you know, that's when I talk about all the other things, because I'm just kind of disturbed by, and the more I researched for this book, the more I found this to be true of when we're pregnant, it's all about us. Then you have the baby and it's all about the baby. Mm-hmm. And we are, you know, we're one in the beginning for quite some time. And so it has to be both. And I really think it actually has to be the whole family's well-being that has to be considered.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. I love that. Yeah, we call it actually, the way that I teach it, it's called a birth map. And it's kind of the same idea that it's like, there's so many different paths to this destination of getting mom and baby, you know, healthy baby, healthy mom here at the end. But so many different things that can happen and turns you might have to take. But support is where it's at. That is top of the line, number one. Just like you had mentioned, you know, you can have the what looks like the best birth on paper and it can be traumatic. Just like you can have an emergency cesarean and some other things that may be traumatic and come out of it feeling great because it was the right thing to do because you tried all the things because you were supported throughout. I'm with you on that. Okay, let's talk about bringing baby home because we know it can be pretty overwhelming as new moms. We've got this new baby. We're bringing him home. What do you think parents should be focusing on during those first few months? Or what are some of your best tips for those first few months and weeks?
Yeah. So the first few months are, I think, having realistic expectations and really have this first 3 months. We talk about the baby, you know, Dr. Karp talks about, you know, it's the fourth trimester for the baby. I think it should be also the fourth trimester for the family.
Right.
Right. So we need to be focusing on healing, you know, nutrition, bonding, and a calm environment, honestly, you know, and even though I know that there, I was just talking to another parent who was like, you know, my in-laws met us at the house and they had balloons and all the candle, you know, cake. And it was too much. It was completely overwhelming. It'd be better for it to, you know, to be much more quieter. And thinking about, you know, we live in, well, honestly, this has now become a global. It's not just, let's say, in the United States or North America, where there's really much an expectation of like, you have the baby, you get back on it, right? You're, you know, you're looking good, you lose your baby weight, you should look great on Instagram, you should feel motivated and do all of those things. And like, you know, most of us who've had a baby are feel like, I'll just speak for myself, I didn't feel that way. I thought, you know, breastfeeding was harder than I thought it would be. I was completely unprepared for the amount of crying. I also felt like, why didn't anybody tell me that labor and delivery hurts a lot? Or, you know, there was all of these, you know, emotions and things to consider. And so realistic expectations regarding our baby and sleep. These are two important things. One is our brain and our partner's brain changes when we have a baby, not just because, oh, you know, our hormones are shifting and we're creating milk and, you know, and our uterus is contracting and helping us, you know, get back, into, you know, pre-baby, stage, but it's also changing our brain so that it makes it harder for us to multitask. That might be hard for, you know, if you were like fast paced before you had a baby, all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, what happened to my brain? I can't remember anything. It's on purpose. It's supposed to make it so that you zero in on your baby, and attune to them, attach to them, and learn how to read their cues and know that they're trying to figure out how to communicate their needs to you, because in utero, they didn't have to communicate anything, right? It just happened. And so if we take, you know, that knowledge that, wow, I need to focus on that, therefore creating that calm, nurturing environment for all of us, then I would say the other thing is to remember that our baby's brain is in a really primitive state. They don't understand, you know, even like your partner, husband, whatever, drops a pan in the kitchen in the other room and makes a huge noise. They startled. They don't know, like, oh, somebody dropped something in the kitchen. Right. And so that's pretty much like anything. Who are these, you know, strangers in my face talking loudly? They can't even like turn their head away. Mm. They don't know yet how to do that. So I think reminding ourselves that they don't know how to do that, and therefore we need to, again, have that kind of calm, low stimulation environment. We all learn better in a calm, regulated state than one when we are feeling dysregulated and off. And then the other thing is focus on feeding, because that's really your number one, you know, most besides, of course, you know, making sure your baby's not sick, or after those things, yeah, it's feeding. And so if you're breastfeeding, being in communication with a lactation consultant, if you're formula feeding, you know, being in touch with your pediatrician and making sure that's going well. And then in terms of sleep, then it's really focusing on avoiding day-night confusion. Mm. And I don't know if you want me to kind of go into a couple of tips, yes, on that. Because I
think that sounds great.
Okay, good. So our internal clock, which is called the circadian rhythm, tells us when to be asleep and when to be awake, right? And it doesn't like it when we operate off mode. So with our babies, that internal clock is not developed for several months. It just starts to get developed around 3 to 4 months. And it really is around, right? And then is more kind of solid 6 months. And then our children's sleep architecture continues to change for the first 2 years of life. So remember that. So that means then if their internal clock is not developed for several months, then we have to be what I call their external clock. So we want them to get to the feel or the energy of what do we do at night and what do we do it in the day. So at night, everything you should try to create. And I know in the beginning, your baby's bedtime might be around your bedtime, or you'll be sort of trying to figure that out. Try to slowly get to, okay, it's going to be, and I hate to give a time because then people are like, oh, she said the right baby, you know, like you have to watch your baby's cues. But a lot of times in the beginning, it is later, and that you have a quiet bedtime routine. And you're, you know, room darkening shades, you're dimming the light, you know, swaddling them, and, you know, white noise if you want, and, you know, putting them in their sleeping area. And yes, it's okay if you're feeding them to sleep. This is the beginning, right? They don't have any self-soothing skills. And then all night wakening, same thing, quiet, dim light, right? We're kind of giving that vibe. I know your body doesn't know this yet, but my body does. It's nighttime. And during the day, it really is a time for us to open our shades. Ideally, if the weather is nice enough, go outside, get some fresh air, but at the very least, open the shades, open windows, have a day experience. And then the other thing, which most people don't talk about, everybody says, you know, don't wake a sleeping baby. Here's one time where I would say during the day, wake your babies within 3 hours if they're sleeping so they don't miss a feeding. Because we want to try to give that message like, oh, let's try to eat more during the day, even though in the beginning we're probably going to be pretty equal. Yeah. And have a long, you know, save, if you will, our long stretches for the nighttime. And that will really help. And then you'll begin to like, oh, I start to see we're going to start our day at this time in the morning. That seems to be a typical time. And it helps bring us a very, I don't want to say schedule, but a beginning framework for the day.
Yeah. You know, I think that's good for moms too, as you're talking about, you know, treating the whole family and everything, because it can be really easy to kind of slip into that depression if we're not. It's like you need to be eating healthy and make sure that you're drinking water and take your vitamins and get outside in the sun every day. And you're even like, I love this, like, and get up in the morning and open the windows and like, it's daytime for everybody. You know, I think that's part of soothing for mom too. It's super important. You call your approach baby led. And I know that there's a lot of, you know, like I've even had somebody on recently who talked about baby led weaning. But this is baby led and you're talking about sleeping. Will you talk about what you mean by that? And how does it connect with what you call your fast approach?
Yeah. So, you know, I didn't come up with that name until I was like solidly through my second draft of this book. Mm. And that often happens when you write a book. I started with the fast and then I thought, wow, you know, and that's what I, one of the things I like about baby led weaning is that it, you know, it's about the baby, right? Giving you signs and cues and you reading them accordingly. Right. And I thought, well, that's what we're doing here, right? It's not, even though the book is set up by months because I had to find some way to organize it. I really want parents to think in terms of stages, right? You know, even though, because the when a child reaches a certain developmental stage is, you know, it's soft, right? It's not like, oh, at 8 weeks, exactly this will happen. Right. It's like, oh, somewhere between 6 and 8 weeks. So I thought that that was important, that parents felt like, oh, the baby is leading the way here. And as in the beginning, we do everything for the parent, as the parent, to assist them and care for them and get them to sleep. And then as their skills increase, we can do less and less. And sort of, it's like a, I always think of the metaphor of a passing of the baton, but we're with them through that process. And the fast elements are basically the things that we need to consider when, you know, in order to address, improve, and set the stage for great sleep down the road. So first is development, even though I know that's not in the fast, but that's sort of, you know, a given here. And then making sure our babies are well fed, as I said earlier, right? Because a baby who's not eating enough, let's say during the day, is going to need to eat more during the night, right? They need, you know, there's certain guidelines that all babies need. And then the A is for attachment. And it's connected to S, which is soothing, because our first, you know, task for all of us as humans, in Erikson theory, is trust versus mistrust, right? Is that we are first figuring out, can I trust my caregivers to be there for me, to respond to me, to help me meet my needs, that we can't meet ourselves. And that's how this secure attachment begins to be formed. It doesn't happen overnight.
Right.
it happens over years. But these, you know, and the first 3 years are very pivotal. And I would say even these first few months are really essential and critical. So I want parents to be responsive because, again, that's what we're doing. We're saying, I'm not saying the minute your baby has a peep, like you run and trip over things and, you know, but you may say, I'll be right there, honey. You know, not that they can understand, but they're going to hear your voice. They know you're responding. And then you go and attend. And we talk about in the book, you do what I call soar. You stop. You observe your baby and you assess, like, why are they crying? What do they potentially need? How long have they been awake? When did they last feed? What's the environment? What's going on? Do they seem physically comfortable? And then we respond accordingly. And so that kind of connects with soothing, because in the beginning, our babies don't know how to differentiate their cries. And we don't magically know what every cry means. I think that that's something I even felt like, oh, when I had my first child, oh, geez, you know, we're supposed to know all of a sudden, like, what if I don't know, right? And I realized after many, you know, years that it's a process that, and especially after I learned that they don't even differentiate their cries for months, that I felt relieved.
Yeah.
I thought, okay. So part of them learning how to differentiate their cries is in that relationship between, you know, their caregivers, like, and how you respond. And by the way, you're going to get it wrong sometimes. We all do, but that's okay. And then finally, the T that is so hugely overlooked in sleep coaching in general, and I think really in parenting, is temperament. Mm. It is a big factor. And even though science says we can't really see what a baby's temperament is until around 4 months is like the time when science says, oh, we can say this more definitively. If you've ever had one of these intense babies, or what I like to call alert babies, you can tell very early on. I remember my second one was like this. And I remember at the 2-week checkup, my pediatrician was like, uh-oh, you got yourself a Tigger. From Winnie the Pooh, instead of like a calm, mellow Winnie the Pooh. And I was like, what? But of course, you know, by 4 months, I 100% knew that this baby's had a different temperament. And depending on your baby's temperament, that will affect, first of all, how much stimulation they can handle. And they already can't handle a lot. And how fast you can move in sleep shaping and coaching, and even when you might be able to start, because these babies, it's a little harder for them to filter out their environment because they're so engaged with it, and to self-regulate. So they really need a lot more help from us in the beginning to, you know, take it down so that they can learn, and sometimes on a slower pace. By the way, nothing to do with IQ. Those children, there's actually studies that say that it's linked to slightly higher IQ. So just want to make sure nobody's thinking that way.
Okay. I like it. I appreciate that approach too. I think it all makes sense. And I love those little acronyms that just remind us of what to do along the way, especially when we're tired ourselves. So that's really perfect.
Yeah.
One of the things that I noticed and that I appreciated actually about your book was you add in every section has self-care for mom. Will you talk to me about why you did that and why you think it's so important? Mm-hmm.
You know, I fought for those sections, because, you know, in books, you know, pages are expensive, and especially now in our world with supply chain issues. And so I said, I don't want to cut it out. Mm. And partly because of the point I made earlier about the focus of once you have the baby, it becomes all about the baby and not about the parent, on top of societal pressures. I think, honestly, globally, to just get back to work right away, or even if you're fortunate enough to be able to stay at home, it's still get back to your life before.
Yeah.
And I read this amazing book called The Postpartum Depletion Cure. He's a physician in Australia who taught, and he differentiates depletion from postpartum mood and anxiety disorder. And not that you can't have both, and depletion can't set you up for that. Absolutely. But he talked about how our world has moved away from that fourth trimester for the family, and what that does to us, and that it sets up a depletion from the beginning, and how there's this sort of disconnect between baby and mom, when really in the beginning, you know, we're one, or the baby thinks that we're one. They still don't completely understand that they are a separate being. And so I felt like it would have been a disservice to say, to talk only about the baby.
Yeah.
Cause you know, it's just like when you're calm and centered, you know, really, honestly, the whole family is more
so
able
true.
To be calm.
It's so frustrating sometimes, but it's so true.
Yeah, because, you know, they say that the women are sort of like the emotional keeper of the family and the hearth of the family. And so it's even more important that, you know, we take care of ourselves. And one day you will be a model to your children of that. Yeah. You know, as, even though my girls are in their 20s, you know, I was modeling it way earlier, whether I was aware of it or not, or good at it or not, right. You know, you do model that. And but for this stage of parenting, it's because your baby's affected by where you're at. And so that's why it's so important.
Something that you talk about too, just before we get into kind of wrapping things up here, so we're not here too long. But something that you talk about, and I love this topic as well, is co-sleeping and bed sharing. And mm-hmm. I want to hear a little bit about that in regards to sleep, kind of what your recommendations are, maybe how to do it safely, or just kind of, I don't know, a couple of tips and tricks real quick.
Yeah, I think that that should be part of the birth plan. Maybe it's not the birth plan, right, but whatever your roadmap, as you call it. Love that, that you discuss that. And then you have to give yourself grace to know that you may have a baby that doesn't work well for bed sharing or co-sleeping, or you don't really like it. Or your partner doesn't like it, but more importantly, you can't get any sleep.
Yeah.
And that will further deplete you and be really much harder to function in the way that we all want to function. So give yourself that room, because you don't know who you're going to get.
So true.
And you don't know how it will be for you. Like for me, I thought I was going to like that, having them right next to our bed. But every squeak, and babies make a lot of noise in the beginning because they have 50% REM sleep, which is that light sleep. I was awake. Right. At the same time, 60% of parents will co-sleep at some point in the first year of life. So it's important that we do it safely. And if you decide, as an example, you're not going to, and your baby's going to sleep separately in a separate room or in room sharing, but you find that you're often in desperation bringing them into your bed that has a pillow top and quilts and, you know, right, everything else, then I would encourage you to create a safe backup plan, whether that's like a futon in the room, or you put the bassinet in another room and you sleep on a mattress on the floor, or whatever it is, so that you're not bringing the baby into an unsafe sleep environment. And it could be a couch, a rocking chair, things like that. So I think, again, thinking forward. And then a nice in between, honestly, is the co-sleeper right next to the crib that can have the railing down, where you can easily take your baby in and out, and you can even like touch them to sleep back to sleep, you know, soothing, patting, even just having your hand on them, or if you're feeding or rocking to sleep and putting them in the co-sleeper right next to your bed and laying your hand on them, it's kind of a nice happy medium, because then also once your baby gets a little bit older and you no longer want to go to bed super early, or you want them to nap and you don't want to nap, you can have them nap there and put up the railing. Yeah. So it's a nice in between. But I think it's important for parents to just think that through and not have it be. And also, that's another one of those myths that if you co-sleep, you'll never get your kid out of your bed have a lifetime.
I don't agree
with that either. I mean, I think even if you co-sleep, your baby at some point has to learn how to put themselves to sleep independently. So you're not also going to bed at 7 p.m. kind of thing. But other than that, when done safely and everyone's happy in the family with it, I'm a supporter. Yeah,
I loved it. All the talk is honestly making me wish I had my little guys back in my bed. Even as they got older, I've had moments where I was like, to my husband, Michael, please, let's just like filter them through this week and just let them sleep in the bed. You know, my husband hates it. And of course, they're older and turning around and kicking us and whatever. But I just loved sleeping with my baby so much. And for me, I did get more sleep that way. I was like, oh, if I don't have to physically get up and sit in a rocking chair with you, like I can just go like this and lean my arm over, and like this yeah. to the other side. It was, yeah. Once I figured that out, it was gold. But you're right. Personality. And it was the same thing for us. Like, I'll just share it now. Like, my husband at 6 months was like, I am not sleeping. Like, they can't be in the bed much right. longer. And we had to figure that part out too. So it's whatever works for your yeah. family. But yes, I love, as long as you're doing it safely, that's an option uh-huh. for all families yeah. to be able to do that. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
And that, you know, and that you're thinking kind of longer term, where do I want this to go? Sure. And that you're setting this date. I love the baby whispers saying, do now as you mean to do later. Just maybe you don't have to do it now, but sure. you want to have, as you say, that road map yeah. so that I know how I'm going to get
yeah.
there.
Yeah. I love that. Okay. Before we get off of here, will you take a moment and talk about your new book release? Cause it's coming out soon.
Yes, it is. I'm very excited. I know there's a big picture of the cover. It is coming out on March 21st. You can buy it at, you know, bookstores and online anywhere near you, you know, inside the U.S. and outside of the U.S. And before that, you can pre-order it and go back onto my website at sleeplady.com, and we'll give you some great book bonuses. We have a really fun digital planner and some other PDFs, and you get a free preview of my newborn course that will be released a week later.
That's awesome. I am all about, when I buy books, I love to get the bonuses. So if you guys are listening today and this conversation was good for you, go pre-order the book and get all the bonuses, because that's where it's at. I love it so much. And I'll show it here for those of you that are watching with me now, but this is the new book that I've been so blessed to have early. Thank you so much, Kim, for sending that. That was awesome.
You're welcome.
And will you tell people where they can find you too? How do they connect with you? Social media, email, website, all that stuff.
Yeah, super easy. The Sleep Lady.
Awesome.
Both on Instagram, YouTube, you know, Facebook, Pinterest, and of course my website, sleeplady.com.
Perfect. And I'll have all that in the show notes. So thank you so much for your time today, for your knowledge, for the care that you have taken into serving women well. I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you, Stephanie. Thanks for having yeah. me.
That's it for this week, but make sure you subscribe to the podcast so that you get notifications first as I drop a new episode every week. And don't forget to head over to myessentialbirth.com for all of the free downloads mentioned here and to join the birth course and community serving pregnant moms just like you. If you enjoyed this and other episodes, I would love it if you would take a few minutes to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. I read every single one and include one at the beginning of each episode. See you next week.